Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm John Connors. I'm your host. I'm also the founder and head instructor at Connors Martial Arts in Norwood. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. Reach out to us. We'll set you on your martial arts path. We'll make your life better, more fun, more meaningful. You'll meet a lot of wonderful people. You'll get fit and shape. Your confidence will grow.
Well, look, I was just thinking this as you're talking, right? What of the people who step through the doors to the academy,
yeah,
what percentage are happy they did it, roughly? It's going to be over 90, right?
I don't know. And I'm speaking, of course, to Dan Robin, my host, co-host. I think nobody regrets it, right? Even if they find out it's not exactly what they want to do.
So how many things in life do you have that sort of odds, the opportunity where you're like, 95% chance I'm going to be glad I went in, you know?
I think it's 100% chance you're going to be glad you came in. I think it's going to be, I don't know, 75-80% chance that you love it and it's life-changing.
What else do you have odds like that?
Not much. And it's fun. It's not like you're going to go vegan or something. Yeah. Make your life better, but you can't.
But it's miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's pretty good, man. So how you doing?
Yeah.
Oh, Dan.
Yeah, I'm all right.
And?
And what? And how are you doing?
How am I?
With your thing, you got your ring?
You never ask me. You always forget to ask me.
Yeah, I know. I know. Like, it would be nice if one time you asked how I'm doing. I'm always like, fine. I think I might do that in real life, too, where people are like, how are you? I'm like,
I totally get it. Right. You don't really care. Nobody's even telling the truth. They're all like, yeah, it's all good.
Well, that's the other thing is what everyone does is says great. That's right. How this whole thing started on this podcast where I'm like,
and we learned your rating system.
Yeah. But that was the genesis of it, right?
Yeah.
That it was like, everyone goes, fantastic is like the standard. It's like, why? Right. You never question that. Like, why are you doing fantastic?
Tony Robbins says I'm supposed to say fantastic.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That worked for me. I'll feel the same whether I say fantastic or not.
So as you know, I've been using my Oura ring.
Right.
I just use it for sleep. I don't walk around with it. I found that wasn't that useful.
And just as a reminder, this is like a measure of your wellness.
It's a biometric device. So it's like a ring I wear on my finger and it measures heart rate and all other respiratory things, different things like this. And I guess if you wore it and you went jogging, it would measure how far you ran.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 10 about the ring.
Yep.
What is your level of suspicion of it not working, not doing anything accurate? If like 1 is like I'm a dead on positive that it works accurately and measures shows exactly how I feel, and 10 is like it's garbage.
I think as far as sleep measurement is concerned, it's pretty close to 10. Like it gets down to the minute when I go to bed, when I get up.
That's pretty good.
I think it's pretty good. Yeah.
But you think it's mostly sleep measurement?
That's what I'm using it for.
Right.
I really haven't tested the other stuff because I haven't been doing much running. I've been doing some rowing, and most of my activities Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which I don't think it could measure because it's a different type of working out.
Yeah.
I think these biometric devices, they probably measure your arm swings or something, right?
Yeah.
Or your some GPS thing where they can tell how far you traveled and what time.
Yeah, I thought about that when this is a naive question, but if I jog with my phone on a treadmill, it gives like a rough estimate of how far I ran. Like, what is that? It's just my arm swings?
I'm guessing.
Right, because how can it possibly
be sort of
like if that thing's in my pocket,
gyrograph in it,
if it's in my pocket on the treadmill, I can't possibly know.
I don't know how the hell
that it's moving.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know.
I assume it wouldn't. I've never had it in my pocket. I always hold it.
I don't know, but last night I got my highest score when I woke up this morning, Dan. I got an 85 for readiness. Highest before that was an 81. Usually I'm in the 60s or 70s, so that's pretty good.
That's pretty good, and you have another measurement, right?
It says I can put on my crown. It says when your sleep readiness or activity score is 85 or over, you'll be awarded with a crown.
Oh, are you going to get a crown? Like a virtual crown?
I think it's a virtual crown.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet.
Oh, so what you're saying is I have another device.
Yes, the HRV.
So here's the thing about the HRV.
Heart rate variability.
Heart rate variability.
So the more variability you have, the better you're doing.
Not always, Dan. So basically, if the device has enough information about you, enough data, it can see where your baseline is. And if you're slightly above baseline, that's probably very good. If you're way above baseline, that's probably not good.
Okay.
So, that being said, on Tuesday, on a score of 1 to 10, it gave me a 1, a red 1, which is basically like you're about to drop dead.
Well, you're about to drop dead.
I couldn't tell, to be honest. And I didn't get a super low score in my sleep score. So, it says you're not supposed to work out at all. That was Tuesday. So, I went in and worked out in the morning.
On Tuesday?
On Tuesday.
I saw you on Tuesday at
noon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went and worked out. Right. Yeah. And then I went and worked out at night. So I worked out. I worked
twice on the day you weren't supposed to.
Hard, right. When I wasn't supposed to do a damn thing. So I woke up the next day, and it's and the HRV said I was 3, which is also don't work out. Yeah. You're in terrible shape.
Death's door.
Death's door. So I went in Wednesday, and I worked out at noon. And then I went back and worked out at night. And then I woke up Thursday, and it said I was at 10. Just perfectly recovered, ready to train.
Like ideal state, right? 10 is as
ideal
as it
state.
Goes.
Very rare. As rare as getting the 1. Very rare. So I don't know what the hell's going on with that HRV thing. It's only 2.5 minutes. It's a real snapshot. So it's probably too thin of a slice to be meaningful. So today, when I got an 85 with the O-ring, I got a 7 with the HRV.
So everything's coming together.
I guess so. Yeah. And I'm competing tomorrow at the Boston Open.
Right.
Jiu-jitsu.
And that's where this is all headed. That's also why you had to work out whatever their HRV said. You had to come in.
I didn't have to. I was just being stupid, but I wanted to. Yeah. I started this thing like a, this guy, Andy Frisella, he has a podcast. He calls himself the MF CEO, the mother effing CEO. So he's this super masculine, macho, over the top business podcast. So he had this thing for 75 days. You are supposed to eat completely clean, no cheat days, no cheat meals, no alcohol. Drink a gallon of water and work out twice a day, and then like read a personal development book for 10 pages or something.
Every day for 75 days.
75 days. So I basically have been doing that, Dan. And one of the workouts he says should be outside. I haven't been doing that, but the jiu-jitsu workouts are as difficult
as anything.
Yeah,
you open that door in the back here.
There you go. So I've been, actually, this is day 18 of no alcohol and of doing the thing. And it's good. I lost at least 11 pounds. Maybe
that's
more.
That's a lot of pounds.
In 18 days. That's pretty good, right?
75. So you've got 57 more days, though. Something like that.
It doesn't sound good when you say it that way, Dan.
Well, I like to find the negative.
We'll see. But now I'm on weight, because before I was up at like 184, 185 and was really struggling. I'm like, am I going to make weight? I mentioned at one point, I said to my son, yeah, I'm 9 pounds overweight. And he said, no, you're not. You're in another weight category. Yeah. You're not over something else.
Yeah, you're at the next weight category.
You're in the next weight category. And I was like, oh, right.
So now you're good. What
I've been
weight you're
completely
competing?
Clean, and now I'm down. I weighed this morning. I weighed 173. So
73?
173.
You're tiny.
Yeah, so I got to be fucking 181 change. With a gi on. So that means probably walking at 77. So
you're ready
I'm
to
like
go.
3 or 4 pounds on.
You're not going to have to do any sort of cut.
No, not at all. I'll hydrate. I'll eat well today. And I feel good. I'll be ready to go.
So Saturday afternoon.
Saturday afternoon. So the interesting thing about this is we've talked about the ego trap a lot on this podcast. This was actually a big ego trap for me.
You said it's your biggest one, right?
Like, I think it is.
So quick summary is the ego trap is like putting yourself out there in short. Like, you know,
I would say it's when you feel overvalued and you feel like you have nothing to gain and you have only something to lose. You have only esteem
to lose. So in your case,
you're
the owner of the gym.
Owner of the gym.
Everyone thinks you're a very good grappler.
Right. They think you're invincible.
Already.
Right.
So why go up against someone that can beat you and make yourself
right
look bad?
If you happen to lose, you're probably going to lose esteem with your students.
Like, you can literally win a world championship and people are like, oh,
Dan,
I thought you would.
I won the Pan Ams, no-gi Pan Ams last year. I got a silver medal in the no-gi world championships and literally nobody batted an eye. Right. Like, impressed. You know who would impressed?
No. Who?
Nobody. So it's like, silver medal. They're like, ah, better luck next year.
Yeah.
I think somebody said to me, well, you either win or you learn, so I guess you're going to learn.
Oh, someone said that?
Yeah. People basically looked at it as a loss.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
That's the truth.
I think what people might be missing about, like, when you go to something like the Worlds, you in particular, is that the guys there will literally, you correct the number, but it's like, in the past 3 years, they've been in 25 tournaments something like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
They do it professionally.
They do it, yeah.
And they're
all
good.
All the time.
They're good. Yep.
And you're kind of rolling in having not done it or having done one prior to that.
Right. I'm doing hold my beer and step it out there. Yeah.
Right. And so I think people might not get
They probably
that.
Don't. But it doesn't matter.
Right.
I got to be on my own path. So my path. So competing locally against another local guy. You know, you could set this up as like, oh, this is bragging rights, blah, blah, blah. You really put yourself in a place where you could perceive, a person could feel like, I got a lot to lose here. Right. I could lose a lot of esteem. Actually, when my son mentioned it to me, I was sitting on the mat after training.
Mentioned the tournament to you?
A few weeks ago, I was sitting out there, and my son goes, hey, you know, Mr. Spock, my son, we went over that last episode. He goes, hey, you should do the Boston Open. And boom, I had a stress response, man.
You felt like adrenaline?
Oh, totally. Yeah, my chest went, heart rate went up. I got a little sweaty. My breathing started. I was like, oh, yeah? And I did not want to do it in the worst way. I had such a stress response from it.
And so this is the difficult, the next step is the difficult one and that we talk about on this that most people don't take, which is if you have that stress response, and your first thought is, I don't want to do it. Most people don't do it.
They don't do it.
Right.
You go
home. Which is logical, right?
You
You're like, that makes me feel
uncomfortable. Make a drink for yourself and you watch Netflix and you forget all about it.
Right.
And then
and
you
so
feel
you,
good.
Right. And so you deliberately, in keeping with what we talk about on this podcast, you went in the face of it.
I
and
did.
And said, I'm going to do it no matter,
I
despite
did.
My discomfort.
Right. So why did I do that?
Right.
I think to gain self-knowledge and to gain some knowledge for my students so I can have the experience, so I can come back to them and help them. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but isn't there also, I mean, that's the logical, that's the outward reason, but isn't there an internal reason too of confronting this discomfort? Like of saying, I have this stress response. And
yeah, but that's the next level. So
internal,
why do you confront the discomfort? It's like the hero's journey. The hero goes out on a journey and goes through an ordeal, and he gets new information, and he brings it back to the tribe. You know what I mean? I can be, the self-knowledge part. I'll learn about myself. I'll make myself better, and I can be a better coach, and I can help my students by doing it.
Don't you feel you can come out stronger, too? Like, it's similar.
No doubt.
I don't know if this is a weird comparison, but you told me decades ago, you, as one, something that was very uncomfortable for you, but you got up on stage and did stand-up comedy.
I did that for probably a year, yeah.
And wasn't that also, you were like, this
that
is...
That was probably one of the most terrifying things I could have thought of doing.
I think most people would agree with that. Most people listening would not want to go up
in
front of people and try to make them laugh. It would be very tough.
Right.
Most of the people that feel they would be really good at that would not. That's been my experience. Like, if someone is not uncomfortable, I know a handful of people in my life that have been like, oh yeah, I'm hilarious. I'd go up there. Every last one of them is not hilarious and like would not, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like you're in delusional. I think anyone that has the insight to come up with jokes that were actually funny also have the insight to be like, this is very intimidating. Like, people might not laugh. People might not like me. People, you know, I
think
might
so. Even I
there.
Think some of the pros talk about how it sucks when they fail.
Yeah.
I think I was listening to Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller. Man, they've been killing it for decades, killing it. I think they own like their own venue. Yeah. And then he'll talk about when some bit went really bad and nobody laughed and how he had flop sweat. So I think even those guys feel
I think
it.
You never get past it, right?
Yeah.
You hear Jerry Seinfeld say he bombs. I heard just recently, you know, like Steve Martin and Martin Short are doing teaming up and doing crossing the country.
Okay.
I mean, who's been doing it longer than, you know, like, that's as
Steve,
long.
Yeah, they've been, Steve Martin's been doing it as a teenager. Yeah.
And Martin Short was telling a story about, you know, Steve Martin will be like, I'm really excited to add this bit to our show. It's going to, I think it's going to kill.
Oh, right.
And then he goes to say it and it bombs.
Right.
And he said they're at a point now, though, they can sort of like, they meet, they lock eyes on stage and kind of laugh. Like that the big bit just bombed. But the point is, though, he still bombs, like, you know, years in and years. So there's always discomfort of getting up there. So the parallel is you got up there just to face the discomfort.
Well, actually,
like, this discomfort, I'm going to face it head on. I feel there's a parallel to what you're doing now. You're like, there's discomfort around performing locally against someone I know, around people I know, and you're facing it, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. And here's another way I framed it. I thought to myself, you know, I want to be a world champion, Masters world, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion someday. Might be this year, next year, 10 years from now. You know, I could, theoretically, I could keep showing up until I'm so old, no one else shows up.
Everyone
and I get
else,
a free medal.
Everyone
and,
else dies.
And you know what? I'll take that freaking medal, man. I will take it.
You outlasted him.
I would have earned it, right? So basically, I have a foolproof plan of getting that gold medal in the World Championships. So I said to myself, oh, so what do I have to do today or whatever to get closer to that goal? And doing this tournament gets me closer to that goal. Undeniably. Yeah. You can't argue anything else.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
Yeah, in the experience, which we already talked about, you're so far behind in tournament experience against the guys you'd face.
Come on, Dan. Take it easy.
At that tournament.
I competed a lot as a white belt and a blue belt, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the experience is going to be super helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The experience, and then also facing, just getting up there with, you know, you might feel as big or important to you as that tournament might be, you might feel like this is not as uncomfortable as I felt in Boston, you know.
Correct.
You might be like, this feels easier, you know, at some level.
I think so. I think all those feelings are very subjective because of the ego trap is very subjective. It's my perception of potential loss of esteem, you know. The other great thing about this, Dan, is when you force yourself to do something this uncomfortable and painful, is now I got to figure out around this pain or discomfort. So, you know me, I'm a researching type of person. Yeah. I'm like, what can work? What are the tools out there that are going to help me? So it sort of plunged me into this search, which I've been doing for, you know, at least a decade, I would say. You know, I remember in 1999, I went down as a blue belt. In 2000, April of 2000, I did the Pan Ams as a blue belt. And I got a gold medal, but I had such extreme anxiety leading up to it. It was so unpleasant that I thought, gee whiz, this can't be right. I got to figure this out, you know? Oddly enough, I know now somebody put me in an ego trap back then. Did I tell you this story?
No, I don't remember.
So this is really pre-World Wide Web, I think. But there's certainly pre-Facebook, 2000. So Boston Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, they had what was called a forum back then, which is kind of like social media, kind of like Facebook, where people would post things. So before that tournament, right before, like the week before, somebody posted, hey, I have no doubt John Connors is going to win a gold medal at the Pan Ams. Boom, ego trapped. So now anything less than that is going to feel like a shortcoming, a shortfall.
Right.
I think that contributed to my anxiety.
That's interesting, too, because probably a lot of people say stuff like that to encourage someone.
They think they're encouraging.
Because it's the opposite. Like, no one wants to say, I bet you're going to lose, is obviously a lousy thing to say. So the opposite is to go, I bet you're going to win, right? Like,
right.
So it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. And then after your win, people think they're being nice and they go, yeah, I knew you were going to win all along, which isn't very complimentary, actually, even though they say that way. It kind of robs you of the effort and everything you put into it, you know?
Right. So what is the right thing to say in this as a side point is probably just like good luck, you know, versions
ahead of
that.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of versions, good luck.
Or focus on the performance. I always say, good luck, go out there. I'm sure you're going to have a great performance. That's under your control.
So, yeah, or like you did everything you could to prepare. Yeah. Something like that.
Well, that's a big thing, Dan. So one of the big philosophical things that has come back to me is the importance of process. So I don't know about you, but you're a philosophical guy too. Sometimes we have these philosophies, we think about them, rethink, and we sort of change our position. And then sometimes you come back to something and it feels even truer because, you know what I mean, you run it, put it through the paces of skepticism. So I used to always believe process is more important than goals. Then I had somebody close to me who didn't like that idea. So her idea was goals are the most important thing. Have crazy, outrageous, exciting goals. And
we've all heard versions of that, right? Shoot for the stars and all this kind of stuff.
I think they're wrong. I think you can have an exciting goal, but once you set out your goal, then you have to come up a plan to get there and a process to get there. And then you just all about the process then. And then sort of like our friend Craig Lewin swimming 20 miles, he's got his goal. Now it's all about the process of swimming, pacing himself, rehydrating, eating properly. And then occasionally he sticks his head up and says, oh, I got to turn 5 degrees here. I'm a little bit off. And he reorients himself. But it's really you're in the process most of the time. Right. And I think that's a good way to approach it. If you just
focus on a goal. So take into an extreme, you have this goal, a really wild, ambitious goal, but you don't have any plans how to get there. It's pointless.
It's never going to happen.
It's pointless and it won't happen.
Right. And it's unfulfilling. If you have an exciting goal and you figure out the process and you immerse yourself day to day in the process, it's very rewarding. Right. Like the last 18 days of me eating healthy and not drinking alcohol and working out and trying to get better, it's rewarding. I'm already have reaped so much reward in the last 18 days that the result of the tournament isn't that important.
So this brings up something I was going to ask, but the conversation went past it, which is the sort of after the fact. So we're talking about all the preparation, which makes sense because we're pre-tournament. But we've talked about that worst case scenario. You just do terribly, right? Like it's just a bad performance.
Yeah, I'm losing 20 to nothing. I get choked unconscious and I defecate myself. Right. That's the worst case scenario, right?
So if you...
Dimitri, has that ever happened to you on a producing a podcast? All right, good.
I'm a little... I bet it has. But like the other side of it, sometimes people come out and they're like, a bad performance and they're like, they come away without these lessons. They come out like, that wasn't worth it, right? Like that wasn't worth it. I did all this tension, all this anxiety, and I came in, I lost 3 in a row. That sucked. And so,
yeah,
I guess what I'm getting at is I think there's mental exercise to do after the fact too. Like, especially if it didn't go well. If you win everything, then it's...
Well, I think so, Dan. I think you're right. One of the things that I discovered in my research for mental preparation and dealing with performance anxiety is, I've not heard of this concept before. I don't think you can correct me if you've heard of it, but I think it's important and interesting is that we are not our nervous systems. So we're all born into this world. We have some experience in utero and as children, and we have a certain nervous system. So some of us are just more prone to anxiety than others. You know, some of us are cool as a cucumber, like that guy in Free Solo, Alex Honnold.
Yeah.
I mean, how's he never getting nervous. You know what I mean? So I don't want to diminish his accomplishments, but his nervous system puts him in a position where he can do some amazing things. But he's not his nervous system. You know what I mean? And if I'm a person who's a little bit more anxious than someone else, that's not me. You know what I mean?
Right.
And unfortunately, in our Western culture, and maybe all human culture, if men feel anxiety, they feel ashamed by that. And they feel it is them. They feel it is saying something about them. Where I think if you look at it a little bit more philosophically or spiritually, you could say, you know, I'm not my nervous system. I'm not my eye color or hair color. I'm not my height. I'm something beyond, you know, the sort of the physical machine I've been handed. And the nervous system is an important part of the machine that we've all been handed. But if I can figure out some exercises or practices that's going to improve the functioning of my nervous system, that's terrific.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think also when it applies not just to, again, to jiu-jitsu, right? Like it's sort of...
But I think, I'm sorry to interrupt you, yeah. Dan. So my point about that shame that we have anxiety. So yeah. I think a lot of guys have this anxiety and they just try to mask it and hide it because they're ashamed of it because the culture might not accept it and they feel like it reflects poorly on them. Then it doesn't get better. It actually may be a negative feedback loop. If I'm anxious and I'm ashamed that I'm anxious and I'm afraid you're going to think I'm anxious, that might make me more anxious because I'll get discovered for being anxious. And it's just a maddening negative
right.
feedback.
And you probably feel a lot better in a very permanent sense if you step up to that and you recognize it, right? And you come out the other side able to say, that's why I always thought it was valuable. We've said on here before, people like George St. Pierre is able to come out and say, I get extremely anxious before every yeah. single fight I have. And he's in a spot to say it. And you are as well in a way that you know, you look at GSP and you say, well, I can't, he's getting in a MMA fight in front of stadium.
Think
like
about
you can't
GSP.
Judge him. You can't be like, oh, I can't believe you're anxious. Like, you know, it's like,
right.
He's obviously a tough guy and obviously accomplished guy.
And obviously somebody, Dan, who immerses himself with great dedication into the process. Has he ever been unprepared?
No.
He's like the most prepared fighter in the history of fighting, probably, right? And he follows his game plan, as the coach says. So he immerses himself in the process. And that's why he's so successful, you know? That can help overcome his nervous system right. and his anxiety. And
part of what I was getting at before, too, was this idea of after the fact. And all these things. So say a tournament comes by and you do poorly. All those things are still true. You still faced up to these things. You still lost weight. You still got healthy. You still challenged
yourself. I would
say
if somebody did that and they lost 3 matches and they performed poorly because they froze up, they quote-unquote choked, I would say, well, obviously, we have to address your nervous system. We have to develop a practice that's going to develop your nervous system. You know, you've obviously developed your body and your skills, but there's a key element that's the thing that's inhibiting your performance. It's your nervous system. So why wouldn't you just address it and try to fix it? Or at least improve this functioning, you know?
Right.
Which is what I've been doing. So I've had the, what is it called? The Headspace app I've been using this week. It's been pretty good. I do my Wim Hof breathing on a daily basis. And then I found this new book, Dan. Pardon me. This guy, Tom Bunn, B-U-N-N. I'll hold it up to the camera. Panic Free. The 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. So I don't think I have panic, but I heard the guy on a podcast and I thought his ideas could relate to just general anxiety and performing in jiu-jitsu competition.
Right. You never had panic or claustrophobia is not the issue, but.
No, but I think what happens is when the nervous system gets overly excited, all of these things start to arise. Like you get afraid of bridges, you can get afraid of elevators. Like it's just like you get your system on such an edge, any little stressor can trigger something, you know?
Right.
So this guy was originally a fighter pilot, I believe, and then he became an airline pilot, and then he became a licensed therapist, and he started helping people overcome their fear of flying. And he originally thought, I just have to give people information, and if they have all the information, they don't have any fear. But it wasn't that simple, of course, you know.
Yeah. We've talked about that a little on this podcast, or flying in particular. Information and probability is actually what calms me down. Like I said, when you're on a major airline and you hit bad turbulence and everyone gets scared, and I think no large aircraft has ever gone down in the last like 30 years from turbulence.
I think that's literally the truth. Yeah.
So then you're bouncing and you're like, there's no chance.
He quotes some stats here. In the last couple of decades, it's gotten insanely safe.
Yeah.
So if you look back from the 70s or the 60s, of course, The data is one thing, but if you look back just recently, it's so safe.
Because I think most of any incident, even back then, involved takeoff and landing, usually hitting someone else. And then even there, it was like wind shear. For each time that happened, that was like in the 70s or 80s. And then they fix it. You know what I mean? So even like, you know, they make sure it doesn't happen again.
Right.
So by now, I think all the major issues are kind of, all the kinks are sort of out. I mean, there's always something bizarre, but that actually works for me when I'm up there and I feel like the plane bounce. You automatically feel like a little uneasy being bouncing around in the sky.
Yeah.
But I'm able to be like, the odds are incredible.
That, yeah.
You know.
But I think you have a different nervous system than some people. So some people who
have
other anxiety prone issues, it's not going to help them that much, you know. It's happening at an autonomic, unconscious level. That's the thing about all this anxiety, performance anxiety, and quote unquote choking and everything. It's not happening at a conscious level. It's kind of bubbling up. So he has basically two approaches to dealing with it, which I went through the book. I did his exercises. I found it really effective, really good.
Now everyone gets to hear him for free.
They get to hear him for free. Nobody likes to read a book anyway. Yeah.
So you read the book. And
so he has two approaches, basically. One is called a vagal breaking. So vagal is, they're talking about the vagus nerve system. So this is a nerve system that goes directly from your brain, like into your face, I think, into your voice box, into your chest and everything. So these nerves don't even go through your spinal column because they want to act as quickly as possible. And what he essentially says, one of their functions is a social alarm attenuation or social cueing. So in other words, you know, we hear some loud noise. We don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, and I get a little startled. I look over at you, and if you're smiling, and you're like, hey, no problem, bud, and you slap me on the shoulder, those vagal nerves start to give me a relaxation response. They turn on that part of my autonomic nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, and they start to relax me.
Right. As a quick, the negative side of that, right, that's why you have, you know, smoke coming out of a theater and everyone looks around. No one goes crap and just gets up and runs. Like a lot of people kind of look around like, so
looking for social information,
right,
social
why
cues.
Is that? Yeah. And like when you should get out of there.
I said,
I think I've brought it up with you before that I've always, one of my lessons to my kids was leave, right? Like when, if you see something like that, don't look around to see what everyone else
That's
is doing.
That's a good lesson.
Like,
in doubt, just leave.
Yeah. Just leave. Just get out of there. Something weird is happening. Get away from it. You know, like you don't have to sit there looking around, getting social cues. So, but to your point, that is an instinct. You look around, even in very life-threatening situations, you might look around.
Like, yeah, it's a mechanical nervous system that we have, you know, I think for millennia or something. You know, I think when the humans, what I heard another guy, scientist, saying, when humans came out of the trees, out of the canopy, onto the savannah, you know, they were not the apex predator. They were the bottom predator. You know, there's all these megafauna, these huge animals around. Yes. And they needed to learn to socially cooperate in order to become the apex predator, which we have. So part of it is looking at your face, getting information, cues, hearing your voice, the sound and the tone of your voice, and maybe even that touching. And that's important information that's happening very quickly and happening at an unconscious level. So he essentially says, he has a couple of exercises where you visualize a person in your life who you feel like you can let your guard down around, who you feel safe with. And you essentially, you know, he has an elevator exercise. If you're afraid to go up the elevator, he breaks down an elevator experience into 49 steps. Like, I see the tall building. I approach the tall building. I see the elevator. I approach the elevator. I push the button, so forth. Because each moment, he figures, this could be a trigger. And we want to break your stress response, you know what I mean, as quickly as possible. And so you basically visualize this good friend of yours smiling and looking at you and saying something comforting and either hugging you or tapping you or slapping you on the shoulder, whatever
the
they appropriately do.
It's calming that nervous system.
It's like you're conjuring up a social vagal breaking system in your mind, and you do it and you sort of imagine the experience and you imagine this person doing that vagal breaking, I think it's pretty good. I've been doing it a little bit with the tournament. So what I did is I came up with not 49 steps, but a number of steps for competing, like signing up for the tournament.
It's all the lead up.
All the lead up.
Because right. you're not really generally anxious once it's on, right? Once you're actually rolling.
Yeah, when you're out there, it's a different thing. Yeah. But, you know, here's what I think happens, Dan. If every time I think about the tournament, so for example, I get a little stress response, I start training my nervous system to have a stress response around the tournament. You know what I mean? I'm developing associations. Right. I'm ingraining it into my nervous right. system. That's not good, probably. So this is trying to ingrain a vagal breaking into the experience. So you're doing this exercise on a regular basis. You know what I mean? And then he also does a thing called alarm attenuation. So then what he tries to do is do that same association with the different physical manifestations of a stress response. So if you feel your heart rate go up, he does an exercise that associates the vagal breaking with the heart rate. You feel your breathing shortens or whatever, he does that. Your muscles tightening, maybe getting sweaty, or maybe getting a little disoriented. So I think it's very effective. I actually bought two copies of the books, gave it to a couple of guys. I'm getting a lot out of it. I think this has some value. And then he has another method. So one is the vagal breaking. And the other is oxytocin. So oxytocin is sort of like the love hormone, I guess, or the bonding hormone. So when our brain releases oxytocin, we feel connected to the people we're at. And according to him, it's impossible to feel fear and anxiety when you have oxytocin released. So women experience the most release of oxytocin when they're breastfeeding. And men might feel it when they're holding their baby or something. Or, you know, if you're hugging somebody for like 30 seconds, a long hug. Or even, I think he said you can get it from a pet. Like if your dog stares into your eyes or something, you feel that connection. And then you can get it from men. I think men and women, I think he said get it from thoughts of foreplay or afterglow. So after you have sex, you have that release of a lot of different hormones. One is oxytocin, so you feel bonded with your partner, so you'll be more likely to stick around and help raise the young. So that's the sort of evolutionary theory of oxytocin. And so he does the same thing where you associate oxytocin moments with these potentially stress-inducing triggers.
Right. So all this stuff is basically methods of triggering the stress under a controlled circumstance and then reducing that stress through different strategies,
right.
like picturing someone or picturing a scene.
Right, through this vagal breaking or through this oxytocin moment association. And essentially, you're going to this will help you train your nervous system to function better.
Right.
Yeah. And according to him, he has great success with people who are terrified of flying, terrified of elevators. It's just like that. Works great for them.
Right. And to your point, you don't have to be terrified even. You could just be like, I want to reduce my anxiety around
right.
something. And
yeah. Yeah. I want to get better at this. Make my nervous system work better.
Yeah, one like a point that was just kind of hanging out there from before is the – what do you think about people that come out of these things, you know, and they're like, it doesn't go well, and they're like, they plummet down. Like, is there a way to mitigate that where people are like, that sucked, that was not worth it, I'm never going to do it again? And again, it doesn't have to be a jiu-jitsu tournament. It can be, I tried a lot of things. I tried asking someone out. I tried a business venture. I tried a lot of, you know, different hobbies. You're like, and that plummet into like this, just depression or whatever you want to call it.
Where well, like, yeah. Well, I think the purpose
should be a way to
of,
mitigate that, right?
Of depression or sadness is to make you reflect on what happened, what you did, and figure out what you could do differently for a better result. So I would tell the person what you have to do differently is you got to do this work on your nervous system.
Right.
And the proof of it
yeah,
is...
Yeah, and the broader point that you're saying before you run past it is like a lot of people don't, they just
Dan, do you know anybody working on their nervous system?
Not really.
Dimitri, do you know anybody? No, he doesn't either. Yeah. Well, you know me. You guys know me. Well, I'm working on it. Yeah.
Yeah, you. And whoever else you gave the book to.
Right.
But the broader point is that people don't reflect. They don't use that depression to reflect like the way you're supposed to.
Right. You know
I mean, they're just like, they're like, this all sucks and I feel bad. As opposed to, so you're saying the first nudge is to pull yourself out of that enough to be like, what did I learn? Or like,
well,
what,
that's
why,
the purpose of feeling bad is to force you to reflect. So I think if you can reflect and as quickly as possible, learn the technical lesson and move on, that's great. Just like jujitsu, I try to do something, it doesn't work. I get submitted. I wish I didn't get submitted, but what did I technically do wrong? Figure that out, correct that, and then you've got some good out of it.
But that's a good parallel too, because a lot of me included, sometimes like I could get submitted and just be like, oh, gee, I suck. And I don't even think back, like I don't reflect. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
exactly the wrong thing to do.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty common, right? I mean,
I think it is common. It is common, and it's a mistake. And that applies to all parts of life. Like you said, you ask somebody out, it doesn't go well. Reflect. What could have gone differently? Whatever. You know, it may be, you know, maybe you could do some behavior differently, or maybe you've discovered that it's not a good fit or something. Who knows, right?
Right. But isn't it common? Isn't that another good example where a lot of people just feel bad? They don't reflect.
I think so, unfortunately. Yeah.
Including you and I. It's not like we're above it, right? Like,
right. I'm lucky. I train with my son, Rory, who's very much like Mr. Spock, and he's really good at sticking to the technical issues. Mm-hmm. And he helps me a lot. He'll be like, I tried a takedown the other day. It didn't quite work. And he's like, yeah, you didn't go down your hip all the way. Like,
right.
He'll point out the technical issues. So that really helps me a lot. And it's just great to get in the habit of looking at things technically like that, which you're right. Most people do not do that. I remember years ago, one of our friends, I said, yeah, if you're doing something in jiu-jitsu, and if it doesn't work, you go to ask yourself, what else could I do? And he goes, yeah, like more strength training. And I'm like, no. And that's kind of a reflection of like, I'm not enough. I'm inadequate. Like, so I think that's where people go. If something doesn't work out, they focus on, well, I must not be good enough. I'm not adequate somehow. I'm not enough. And instead of like the technical issues.
And you've brought up before, I remember you bringing this up years ago about negative mindset, where like the more negative you are, the deeper you see that failure. So getting tapped, like what you should do is say, what did I do wrong with that technique?
Yeah.
Then one step more negative is like, I'm bad in that position.
Mm.
Another step is I'm bad at jiu-jitsu. Mm. Another step is, and it, all the way down to like, I suck at everything.
I suck.
Like, and some people, like, I suck at, and some people will take it past jiu-jitsu, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm just the biggest loser in the world. I knew I'd lose at this. I knew I'd be bad at jiu-jitsu because I'm bad at everything.
Right.
You know, like, that's the other end. Like, and so the idea is walking that back to like, no, you just got armbarred. Why did that happen?
In that one
like,
moment.
You know,
yeah.
In that moment. And like, and
that's
negative mindset is how
Martin Seligman, explanatory style.
Right.
Personal, pervasive, and permanent. Yeah. Don't make it personal. Don't make it pervasive. Like, oh, I suck at every athlete or every sport. Permanent. I'm never going to be any good. Yeah, that
right.
doesn't
and,
help.
And
you
it
at
applies
all.
Again to the results of a tournament. Like, you know, what I mean, if you lost, why did you lose? It's not. You could imagine someone coming out of the tournament like, I just suck. I suck. You know, and again, the worst case scenario is even beyond you. Like, I knew I'd lose because I always lose. And,
so the why did I lose could be like, technically I needed to do this, this, and this. I didn't do it. But like you were referring to an instance earlier, it could be like their nervous system was so overwhelmed. They couldn't do what they do in the gym even. So they kind of knew what they needed to do. They just couldn't do it. So
yeah, but all this can be teased apart.
Yeah.
Or even if, I know someone, like they take it very personally, like I'm just not athletic enough. It's like you could still work on it. You can work on anything.
And Dan, it's so much better if you approach it that way instead of the glory of Instagram and social media. Like I just want to post a picture of myself with my medal or something like that, you know? I'm getting more and more turned off by social media. I use it for the business, but I don't want to be posting any pictures of myself with medals. I don't know. I don't think it's good. What do you think?
Well, you're in a different situation because you have a business. So you might, you know what I mean? Like you might personally feel humble that you don't want to.
But I think it's distracting because now it becomes too much about that and it's distracting from the process again, because we're talking about the process. Yeah, I'll post a picture when I finally win that world championship, Masters World Championship medal. I'll post that picture. But until then, you know, just have the experience and learn from the experience, right?
I could see it. It also, yeah, I mean, that's a personal, I don't know how much it helps business or not, because that's also, we've talked about that before. It's a funny thing where people like, I want to go to the gym where this UFC fighter.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, how does that help you? You know, like, how does that, you know, like the fact that that fighter was in the UFC does not necessarily reflect whether or not you want to go to that gym or not. But
it's tricky. People, I suppose it helps a little bit, but yeah, I don't know if it's worth it, the trade-off. Yeah.
Do you think posting pictures of medals could help your business?
I think it might. I mean, I don't know. I think
so then
it,
why not? Like, you know,
do you feel? I just don't want to do it personally. I let my students do it, and then it's sort of like speaking to maybe the instruction or the experience or something. But even then, I don't want to have people measuring us by medals or something, or I don't want us measuring ourselves by medals. I just want us to be in the process of improvement, and. And yeah, having a fulfilling life. And like, you know, that if you are suffering from a lot of anxiety, it just sucks, right? Imagine like, oh, I'm going to compete in a few weeks, and like every day you're dreading it. That's, we're not supposed to live that way, right?
That's very common too, right?
We're not supposed to live like that, right? We're here for such a short time. Got to enjoy ourselves a little bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure in a lot of walks of life, if people can figure out good strategies to reducing day-to-day anxiety, it's extremely valuable for a lot of people.
I think so. Without taking medication, without side effects, like all of this stuff this guy's doing, you know, there's absolutely no negative side effects that could come from it.
Yeah, that's something. It's like a blind spot for me, but I think a lot of people out there medicate this stuff, right? So
I think so.
I'm just unaware of it.
Like, even with alcohol or weed, probably, you know.
Yeah.
Definitely. And those don't have. That's the other thing. What I found out, Dan, is 18 days without alcohol, I'm so much, I don't know, this is probably boring, more hydrated than I was. So before, I was always having this point, like at the end of my training, I would have like severe muscle cramps on my abs or my lats or my feet or my calves. And I'm not really experiencing that to that degree, like a little tiny bit, but nowhere near what I was. And it has to be the alcohol, which just makes sense, right? If you have a diuretic that's pushing water out of you and you're trying to put some in, that's just not good.
Yeah.
Well, if you have nothing pushing water out and you're putting it in, well, obviously you're going to be better hydrated. I still drink coffee right now. But so, yeah, that was kind of a pleasant benefit that I didn't foresee coming. It's all good.
It's hard. So 70, what was it, 70 days, 75 days?
The thing says 75. We'll see, Dan. You know, I'm not religious about it, but I feel good and I'm glad I'm on weight. And who knows? Maybe I'll just go to next month, like the end of August, we're competing out in Vegas for the World Championship. So maybe after that, I'll have a little something, something.
Yeah. I slid a little on my slovenly July.
How'd you slide in your slovenly July?
Well, I went to the gym and I, you know, I went to your gym, and then I wasn't going to tell you, but I went to the other gym. I lifted some weights. I ran a little. It's hard. It's hard to stay focused. As anyone who's tried any of these programs knows, it's hard to not slip a little bit. But I think the important thing is to get right back at it. You know, like to, if I accident, you know, and then I ate like some lean meat, you know, I just threw something on the grill and didn't.
And veggies.
And veggies. But, you know, the weekend's coming.
You have no self-respect.
Right. I can try to get back at it this weekend.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have a lot of momentum, so we're eating completely clean. It helps that my son lives with me, and he eats completely clean as well. So,
and you said, I always, you know, hear what, you lose the desire for it pretty quick,
you do.
Right?
Now, 18 days clean, but even before this, if you get like a organic yellow peach from Whole Foods, I mean, is there, and it's the proper ripeness, there's like nothing in the world that tastes better than that. Like, you can't go to a Michelin star restaurant and get a dessert that tastes better than that. It's impossible.
To you.
At that time, right. If you're eating clean. I mean, it's amazing.
That's cool. I mean, what's flashing through my head is at home, I have like one of those cheesecakes with like every two slices is like a different flavor. You know what I mean? Like the chocolate one, then the cherry one, then And I'm like,
you
really?
Think that's beating the peach?
Really? I mean, for me,
right,
it's got the peach pretty soundly beat. But maybe I just need a couple of weeks.
I'm probably an idiot. Yeah. That's very funny. Yeah, it's all relative. I think your taste buds change. Yeah.
I'll do it. I got to pick. I don't think the summer. I'll pick a clean month, maybe September.
Yeah.
It's tough, though, right?
Well, if I didn't have this tournament coming up and I didn't have the World Championships, I wouldn't do it probably. Yeah.
Right.
And I had to make a weight class. If I was probably comfortably under my weight limit,
you also wouldn't have done it. Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have done it. But I feel really good. It does feel fulfilling. I feel good. Like I lost some fat on my belly. So yeah, I feel pretty good, man. Sleep. My sleep is better too. The Oura Ring's telling
me
that.
I believe it works. I mean, I'm eating like crap, and I feel pretty bad. So. I feel pretty.
Might be a correlation there.
I feel pretty,
there.
I feel pretty bad, so you know, could be.
All right, Dan. Yeah, I think we're just about through. Wrap it up.
Good luck. I always forget that by the time this comes out,
You'll
have already.
I've already lost by 20 points and shit my pants. I've got choked unconscious.
Yeah. By the time this comes out, it'll be the most awkward episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure it'll be a great experience.
Good luck 2 weeks ago or whatever
it'll be. So next episode we can tell you the results. We'll recap it.
Right, no matter what happens.
No matter what happens. Well, thanks again, Dan, for another great podcast. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please rate and review the podcast. If you want, check out this book, Panic Free. It's really easy to read because what I like about this guy, he's no nonsense. He's like, go to X chapter. Chapter 19 or something, that's the 10-day plan. So you can skip to that chapter. And then he says, go read this chapter and do this exercise. But I literally didn't have to read the whole book, and I got most of the great information.
I was going to say, you don't necessarily have to slog through the whole book if you don't
want to. Definitely don't. And I got a lot of value out of it already. And I'll let you know if I keep getting value out of it. All right, guys. See you next week.